Right. What about the fact that there is no peace?
They say, well, it's not enough.
So they say, well, it's not enough to change the externals. Real peace is a matter of what is in men's hearts. That's a change that cannot be compelled upon us by force from the outside. Real peace has to start from within. Does that answer the question, or does that avoid the question? The prophets say that lamb will lie down with a lion. Nations shall beat their M16s into plowshares. Right, they will not teach war anymore, they will not lift sword against their brethren. So they say that
the true peace is in the heart.
Even while the world is at war, we who know Jesus the Messiah can have peace of mind and peace with one another.
Really?
A Jew can't. We don't believe that when the world is at war, you can have peace in the heart. You have to be worried about that. But they say it's okay. You can have one guy with peace in his heart because he believes in Jesus, dropping bombs on Vietnamese who maybe also believe in Jesus and got peace in their hearts. Right? Right, is that peace on earth? Is that what the prophets meant? Right, this is very, very obtuse biblical exegesis, I must say. Or they say, for instance, that's one of their answers. Okay. So here we are presenting some of their answers. For instance, they mention, what evidence is there that the things you believe about Jesus are true? So now they're going to bring evidence. Pages of evidence. What proof do you have that Jesus was the Messiah? So, for instance, they mentioned that he was meant to be born of the tribe of Judah.
We already
ripped that apart. Because, obviously, first of all, there are contradictions in the genealogy between Matthew and Luke. Secondly, he wasn't descended through Joseph anyway, because Joseph wasn't his father.
And
third, there are discrepancies between the genealogy in Matthew and Luke with their source of their genealogy, which is in Chronicles. So can forget that. Messiah was to die for the sins of his people. This is a famous one. Dying for the sins of his people. This is Isaiah 53. Famous verse that says 53:5-8. In truth, he has borne our sicknesses and endured our pains. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. He was wounded because of our transgressions, bruised because of our iniquities. His sufferings were we that might have peace, but by his injuries we are healed. Okay, so that's one possible interpretation, as some of the commentary states refers to the Messiah. Of course, we learnt yesterday in the Kuzari that it might also refer to the Jewish people. That we have suffered also for the sins of the whole world, because our task is to raise the moral level of the entire world. And if the entire world is not the correct moral level, that we sometimes suffer because of those sins. Because we are like the spiritual heart of the world. And the heart sometimes suffers if you abuse the body. And how do I have the nerve to say that the suffering servant of God are the Jews? Very simple. We look in Isaiah himself, a bit further back. And Prophet Isaiah says that God himself says that the Jews are the servant of God. I'm just trying to find it. It's Isaiah 48. Verse 20.
Hashem has redeemed
Avdor Yaakov, his servant Jacob. Even though it says servant in singular, his servant Jacob, referring here to the Jewish people, his servant Jacob. So there are other places. Oh, here we are. Isaiah 49, verse 3. Vayomali, he said to me, Abdi Ata, you are my servant, Yisrael, Israel, Asher Becha Espa'er, that in you I will take glory. So God says that you, Israel, are the servant of God. Jacob is my servant. Israel is my servant in whom I will get glory. They point to Isaiah later on where it talks about the servant of God suffering. Who has suffered more than the Jews?
Very few.
Very few. Jesus certainly didn't suffer more than the Jews have suffered. It's open to question who this suffering servant is. In Isaiah himself, previously, it is translated as the Jews. Abdi Yaakov, my servant Jacob, you are my servant. And so again, it's not going to be proof of the Messiah. They say that there's a suffering servant of God in Isaiah, Isaiah 53. And they say that's Jesus. I say, look at Isaiah a few chapters earlier, and it says, refers to the Jews as the servant of God. They're saying Isaiah is referring to the Messiah. Isaiah himself says that he might be referring here to the Jews. In addition, They bring as further evidence, well, they don't bring this because it's not good evidence, the ingathering of the exiles, because it never happened.
But they don't bring that in their list of
And also peace on earth. But they don't bring that in their list of sentences, because that would be a problem. Now here they say, Psalms 22, that Messiah was to die by crucifixion. Now this also is another case of, I just don't know where they're coming from. They're coming from, what's the expression in baseball?
From left field.
Left field. They're coming from left field. Here, Psalms 22, they say Messiah to die by crucifixion. So you look in Psalms 22 and you look in the Hebrew.
They surrounded me.
It says, they surrounded me.
They surrounded me like dogs.
They surrounded me like dogs.
Many, they've surrounded me like dogs.
They've surrounded me like dogs. Like a ravening, they gape upon with their mouths.
The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me.
The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They seize my hands and feet like a lion. In the Hebrew it says, Hikifuni, they have surrounded me. Ka'ari, yadai v'raglai, like a lion, my hands and feet. The word ka'ari means, Ari?
Right, a lion. Ari is a lion. There's no other translation.
Right, a lion. Ari is a lion. There's no other translation of Ari in the Hebrew. Ka'ari is like a lion. If you look in the King James Version,
you know what it translates?
The Christian version of the Bible, you know what it translates Ka'ari as? They pierced my hands and feet.
Where do they get pierced?
Pierced? Where do they get pierced from in the text? The word pierced doesn't appear in the Hebrew in the entire Psalm 22. Now, this is something which at the moment, if you don't know much Hebrew, you cannot necessarily confirm for yourself. But on the other hand, you can look at Ka'ari, look at any reference work you want, and see what Ari means, and see if it means pierced anywhere in any type of literature, in anywhere else in the Bible, and see if it means pierced. It doesn't mean pierced. Nowhere else is there any evidence to that.
That's right. When you hunt a lion, right? You hunt animals.
That's right. When you hunt a lion, right? You hunt animals. You tie the hands and feet together. There's no reference here to crucifixion. None at all.
Or for instance, they mentioned.
Or for instance, they mentioned
Deuteronomy 18.
Deuteronomy 18.
Like
Messiah was to be a prophet like Moses. So again, let's not quote the verse out of context. Let's look at what the verse says.
Deuteronomy 18. It says.
18 verse 15. The Lord thy God will raise up thee a prophet from the midst of thee of thy brethren like me.
To
him you shall hearken. Okay, so it would appear to say, superficially, just thinking in that verse, this prophet will be like Moses. Of course, that's very difficult to say, because at the very end of the Torah, it says,
Verse 10,
there arose not a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. A prophet does not arise amongst the Jews like Moses. But aside from that contradiction, let's look at the context and see what it means when we say a prophet like Moses. It says, when you come to the land which the Lord thy God gives thee, you shall not learn to do the abominations of these nations. There must not be found amongst you anyone that makes his son or daughter pass through fire, or uses divination, a soothsayer, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a medium, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination to the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord thy God drives them out from before thee. You shall be perfect with the Lord your God. For these nations which thou shalt dispossess, hearken to soothsayers and to diviners. But as for thee, the Lord thy God has not permitted thee to do so. The Lord thy God will raise up to thee a prophet from the midst of thee of thy brethren like me. That is the context. It's not a prophecy about a particular prophet who will be like Moses. What he's saying, if you look at the context, is you're going into the land of Canaan. They all listen to soothsayers and wizards and astrologers, etc. Not you. You will have prophets who you listen to, like me. Who is not a soothsayer and not an astrologer or a necromancer. That's the context. So can they claim this as a proof for Jesus? I'll claim it as a proof for Jeremiah and Isaiah and Micah and Obadiah and Amos. And every prophet that went afterwards, right? All the prophets who you don't find there have false prophecies about, my words shall come true in this generation.
That's a false prophet.
Which Jesus does say. That's a false prophet. That's what it talks about next. But
they talk about a future redemption.
They talk about a future redemption. Don't mention the Messiah.
In the prophets, yes.
Explicitly.
In the prophets, yes, many times.
And all the prophecies about Messiah are things like in gathering the exiles, rebuilding of the temple,
right.
Peace on earth.
But
right. The
human being.
A human being.
We find many people, human beings, were called Messiah. The Hebrew word Messiah.
King David was called the Messiah because the Hebrew word Messiah means anointed, Mashiach.
One of the kings of Persia was called the Messiah
because he gave permission to the Jews to rebuild the temple. So he was anointed by God for a particular purpose. Being called Isaiah, Messiah, doesn't mean that makes the Son of God. Also, Son of God is a term used for angels, sometimes called Son of God. The Jewish people are called the sons of God. All of humanity has been called the sons of God. So if the Messiah is called the Son of God, big deal. Does that mean that he will be God incarnate? What does that mean? That he is he has divine inspiration, he is a prophet, he is close to God. That's what we understand. So to make a big deal out of the Son of God is a bit strange, because then you're going to have to make a big deal about all the Jewish people. And on a wider level, every human being in the world is going to create tremendous theological problems for them. Right, so for instance, with some other of their arguments, they bring as a proof the resurrection.
Isn't that a proof?
They say the resurrection. Isn't that a proof? The resurrection is a third piece of additional evidence. First of all, you have to convince me the resurrection took place. You can't use it as evidence. I mean, go into the courtroom, right? And say, well, the resurrection is proof that he was the Messiah. I will tell you, prove the resurrection.
They say
it is perhaps the most convincing vindication of Jesus' claim. Prove that it happened, for heaven's sakes. All right, let's look at appearances of the risen Lord. Okay? And here it says, this is in Matthew 28, 16 to 20. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee. First of all, it mentions nowhere in the Gospels that anyone actually saw the actual supposed resurrection. Which means there were no witnesses to the supposed resurrection. The only type of eyesight witness they mention in the Gospels is people who are supposed to have seen him after he was resurrected. Which means, first of all, it's a very weak case anyway. You've already started off with a weak case. No eyewitness evidence to the resurrection. Only people who are supposed to have saw someone who looked like Jesus. Now look at the reaction of disciples. And remember who the disciples were. They were people who gave up their lives for him. Who gave up their families, their money. They were with him for at least a year, and according to some versions, 3 years. Matthew 28. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted.
Some of the so-called eyewitnesses doubted.
A man who they'd been with for at least a year, and perhaps 3 years. The man who all their hopes had been hinged upon. The man who they worshipped. And some of them doubted. And now Jesus comes and says the resurrection is a third piece of additional evidence. You're meant to convince me 2,000 years later that the whole thing is true because of the resurrection, when no one saw the resurrection, and the 11 disciples who are supposed to have seen him afterwards doubted. And that's the most convincing vindication of Jesus' claim. And let's look in Luke 24, 36 to 49.
As they were saying this, Jesus himself stood amongst
them. But they were startled and frightened, and supposed that they saw a spirit. And he said to them, why are you troubled? Why do questionings rise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet? This is I myself. That it is I myself. Handle me and see me, for a spirit has not flesh and bones as you see that I have. And while they still disbelieved for joy and wonder, he said to them, have you anything here to eat? They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it before them. Bit of a strange type of... I don't know how they explain this, but anyway. He comes up from the dead after 3 days, right? And according to Matthew and according to Luke, here they happen to agree, as opposed to the genealogies where they contradict each other. They agree that in both cases they doubted. They first thought it was a spirit. In Matthew it doesn't say why they doubted, it just says they doubted. In Luke it says they doubted. They still disbelieved for joy. What do you mean disbelieved for joy? Of his coming back would lead you to try and believe it. Because here is the whole lies is hinged upon the resurrection. Everything hinges upon the resurrection. If he dies and doesn't come back, means meaningless. So disbelief for joy, don't understand it. And then, what's his reaction to all this? Got anything to eat?
I'm hungry, I've been dead for 3 days.
It's a bit strange, to say the least. I'd like to hear decent explanations for this. But here they say, the next page, there was no way the resuscitated Jesus could have escaped and then convinced hundreds of skeptical eyewitnesses that he had conquered death forever. He didn't convince them. It says the disciples doubted. Was it all mass hallucination? Who knows? The disciples thought maybe they saw a spirit. And doesn't say hundreds of people. Anyway.
Finally, one of the other proofs they bring.
He provides a total...